Welcome to the Bioethics Babe podcast, where we examine the tough questions in human flourishing in light of science, faith, and culture. I'm your host, Darina Grosso-Agnew. Now let's dive in. What happens when the medical establishment stops protecting children and starts encouraging medicalizing sexual identity confusion instead? Today on Bioethics Babe, we're joined by Dr. Jill Simons, a board-certified pediatrician and executive director of the American College of Pediatricians, who's speaking out about the real risks of social transition and hormonal and surgical interventions for kids with sexual identity disorder. Dr. Simons explains how ideology has replaced science in pediatric care and why she believes children deserve truth, not a pathway to sex-rejecting transition. Stay tuned as we dive into the evidence, the ethics, and the hope for restoring integrity in pediatric medicine. This is a conversation every parent and every doctor needs to hear. Today, we are joined by Dr. Jill Simons on the Bioethics Babe podcast. Dr. Simons is a board-certified pediatrician and the executive director of the American College of Pediatricians. She earned her medical degree and completed her residency at the University of Wisconsin, where she also got started in advocacy, co-authoring research on youth fitness and child restraint safety. After years in private practice in Minnesota, she took on hospital leadership roles, helping launch NICU and pediatric trauma programs, and was honored as a top doc by Minneapolis St. Paul magazine. Dr. Simons is a fellow of both the American College of Pediatricians and the American Academy of Pediatrics, and has been active in developmental, behavioral, and bioethics circles. She's also a consultant in pediatric sleep medicine, contributing to several books to healthy sleep for infants and children. Welcome, Dr. Simons.
Thanks for having me, Arena.
Absolutely. We're so happy to have you on the show. And we will be discussing gender identity disorder in kids and your experience with all of this. But before we get started on that topic, Dr. Simons, I wanted to first understand what drew you to pediatrics during your medical training at the University of Wisconsin.
For me, it started much before medical school. I, as a child, was always curious, loved science, was always asking questions. And my father was a veterinarian, and he and my mom owned an animal hospital. So he put a window into the operating suite so that us girls, he had nine girls, could watch him do surgeries and learn about the science. And he put a little step stool there for me. I'm the youngest. So from an early age, I just was very curious about all things science. But in addition to my exposure to my dad and the veterinary medicine world, I really became interested not only in medicine, but in pediatrics. When I was about in high school, my nephew was diagnosed with cancer, and it was very hard for our whole family. And I remember being at the children's hospital waiting for him during one of his surgeries and walking around and being at this place and, you know, these huge atriums and halls and people walking around. And I just thought, I want to be here. I want to be part of the solution. I don't want to feel helpless sitting here. So that's to me when it started, and then it just grew. And, you know, as I went through college and medical school and I got to see firsthand what it was like, it just was definitely, this is where I'm called to be.
Wow. Well, nine girls, huh? Wow. Amazing. Well, thanks for sharing that. That's amazing that your dad was, encouraging curiosity, especially in the medical field, and encouraging his girls to experience that. So that's beautiful. Thanks for sharing that story. So you spent a lot of years in private practice. What did you value most about caring for children and families in that environment?
It's the relationship. In addition to the patients, working with my partners in practice there. And, you know, medicine, it's more than an art. It's the whole experience. It's the whole environment. And so what I loved about private practice is that we could really be flexible for our families. We could stay open the extra half hour or longer to see the families in the waiting room. You know, the relationships we formed with those families from the time they, you know, took their newborn home from the hospital to through teenage and young adulthood. So those relationships are just, they're priceless. And that's why I think a lot of us practice medicine. Private practice is still, in my mind, a unique world. And it's, I think, the way medicine is supposed to be practiced in small communities, caring for your communities, having control over what you as doctors do. I mean, there's some benefits to large scale practices, certainly, and universities and institutions like that, and the things that they bring. But I think when we started to lose a lot of our private practices, we, as doctors, turned over the control of our art to people who were non-physicians. And we lost those relationships, not only with our patients and our families, but our colleagues. And to me, that's something that I hope we can get back somehow.
And, you know, this is something that we talked about in the first episode with Dr. Joseph Meany about the importance of the relationships. And I think that needs to come back to the center of medicine, because when people are treated like numbers or just a check mark, to check off the boxes, it's not truly dignifying. And so I completely understand why private practice and the relationships come first. And I think that they should always come first in medicine. So thank you for sharing that.
You know, this is maybe an aside, but if I ever recommend, you know, physicians, or if people are struggling which doctor to go see, that's my first reference is, you know, go to who you know or friends know, because that relationship is so important. You could have the smartest doctor who knows everything. And, you know, sometimes you do really need that. And hopefully that doctor has both. But they to know the patient as a person just adds that depth of care that is so important.
Yes. And for example, my family doctor, I've been going to him for 20 plus years, and he is a unique kind of doctor. You can text him. I can text him at all hours asking for prescription or for advice on any medical question. And so that's very rare, I know, but it's super important to find a doctor that you can trust, build a doctor-patient relationship with, and sounds like that's what you were doing in private practice. So as chairman of Pediatrics for Mercy and Unity Hospitals, you helped launch both NICU and pediatric trauma programs. What were some of the biggest challenges in building those programs from the ground up?
I would say getting not only the medical staff, but the business leaders buy-in to spending money on kids. And, you know, kids are relatively healthy. Their medical problems, thankfully, do not require a lot of interventions, unlike things such as orthopedics or, you know, cardiovascular surgery, things like that. So pediatrics is a relative low moneymaker for a hospital, and is not where hospitals, you know, put a lot of their budget for, you know, making revenue. But thankfully, most hospitals do recognize that you need to take care of the kids, because that's part of the family, and that, you know, gets brings the whole family in. So to tell a hospital that you had to invest a lot of money in a program that was not going to have immediate profit or benefits, but would have what we would call a halo effect, in that it would drive in other things to that hospital. And one of the biggest challenges I had was bringing care for our youngest patients. And that meant that you needed to bring in or have your adult anesthesiologists or ER doctors have extra training to be able to take care of these kids. And for good reason, felt like, no, this isn't our expertise. We should turn this over to the big children's hospitals downtown. And yes, sometimes that was appropriate, having kids go to tertiary care centers. But again, like we were just talking about, when you send kids downtown or into these big care centers, you lose that patient-doctor relationship. And when you talk to families, they want their kids in the hospital nearby. They want to be able to have grandma come visit them in the hospital or be close to their other children at home so they can trade off. So there's so many other benefits for caring for children in your community. And making money is just not one of them. And so when we talk about pediatrics, it's talking about supporting the community, taking care of a future generation, which is something we as humans have a trouble with just across the board, that delayed gratification, right? You invest in the future and then see that. So, you know, well, well, most of us, it's easy to have compassion for kids. And how could you not take care of kids? When you translate that to business leaders who are looking out for hospitals, profits, which they should be, it's a tough sell sometimes. So, but we were able to do it very successfully.
It sounds that throughout your career, you put people first, and that's super important, not the bottom line, even though obviously hospitals should be able to at least not be in the red, make some profit. If that's the driving force, again, I think that that's a place where we don't want to be in medicine, where the driving force is financial gain. And so thank you for advocating for children from, you know, your entire career. And again, putting children and families first, especially those in the local community.
I think we can do both. We can run a successful pediatric program, a pediatric clinic that doesn't have to be financially devastating for a hospital. My partners and I in private practice ran a very successful pediatric clinic, and we did it by a lot of hard work, but being flexible, being nimble, and thinking outside the box sometimes. But it can be done. You can run a very successful clinic.
Now, that's amazing. And thank you for clarifying that. I think that's important. Obviously, hospitals want to stay in business, but at the same time, we want to do it from a place where it's putting the patient first. So thank you for sharing that. Looking across your career, from early advocacy to hospital leadership to pediatric sleep research, what unifies your approach to children's health?
I would say just striving for excellence in medicine for pediatrics, you know, the best care, the best research for children, just really elevating that. You know, it's the same what drew me to medicine when I was waiting for my nephew to get out of surgery in that pediatric hospital was just being surrounded by this excellence, this feeling like I want to, you know, bring my expertise as a scientist, you know, study hard and bring that into pediatrics. So I think we've done a pretty good job in a lot of areas, but in some areas of pediatrics, children don't get the best care. You know, traditionally in medicine, children were not given very good care. They were second-class citizens. They weren't as valuable. And so I think we're in danger of that in some areas of medicine right now for children. And we've gotten away with it because children are so resilient. They, you know, their bodies heal very quickly. They are strong. They're young. And so they do seem very resilient to a lot of things. And they are. But there are some things, especially the emotional things that happen to them, families, that do leave deep scars, and that hurt can last and have lifelong effects on their health. And so we need to treat children like the very valuable, precious commodity that they are. They're our future, and we owe them the best that we can give them.
And I think that's a really good segue into the main portion of the show, which is on children with gender identity disorder. And what you're saying rings very true, because they need so much empathy and so much care and so much love. And so that approach to, and especially since they're so vulnerable, I think that it's really important that your attitude and the way that you practice medicine throughout your career just shows that you do put children first and they're what's best for them. And so with that, my question is, after years in private practice and leadership, what inspired you to take the role of executive director of the American College of Pediatricians?
So I discovered the American College of Pediatricians late into my career, even though we've been around for almost 25 years. It was probably about 10 years or so ago, and I was starting to hear about this, you know, puberty blockers and how we treated kids who were confused about their sex. It just didn't make any sense to me. And I was really questioning, could I continue as a pediatrician? Because I couldn't support this. I didn't know how I was going to go against the trend. I thought I was the only one who thought this way. And I remember driving to the newborn nursery one morning, probably 5 or 6 a.m. on the way to make rounds. And I heard Dr. Michelle Curtella, the previous executive director, speaking. And she was talking about this very issue and how this wasn't right, that we were, you know, giving kids hormones and telling them they were born in the wrong body. And I had to pull over. I wrote it down. I thought, this is amazing. There's a whole group of pediatricians who feel like I do. So I joined and became involved. And the more I became involved, I felt like the American College of Pediatricians has to succeed. This, the mission, the message is just critical to not only children, my profession, you know, our future. And so I just became more involved. And when there was a need for an executive director, I felt called to step up because I wanted it to succeed. And I knew I had the skills and the talents and the ability, the time to make it successful. And I had this vision to just really grow it and have our message heard far and wide so that, you know, pediatricians like me didn't have to wait till they were mid-career to hear about them and could feel supported all along their practice journey.
Well, it takes a lot of courage to go against the grain of the predominant medical opinion, which, you know, is very questionable on this issue. So for listeners who are not familiar, what is the mission and history of ACP?
The mission is simple: what's best for children and to support children so that they can be their optimal best physically, emotionally, mentally. And to do that, it's important to support the family. And that's what where children thrive the best. So much like my personal mission to bring excellence to pediatrics, that's very much what the American College of Pediatricians is all about.
And in terms of the history, how did it get started?
So very interesting. One of the past presidents of the American Academy of Pediatrics and several other leaders in the academy were growing frustrated because the leaders in the American Academy of Pediatrics were not listening to their own members. And they were not following the science, and they were starting to have more political and ideological leanings. And they became frustrated with that. And one of the final arguments was the leadership publishing papers that their own scientific policy committee did not back up. And so they broke off and formed the American College of Pediatricians. And in addition to helping children be their best, supporting the family, they wanted to make sure that members approved and voted and had a say in the policies. And so every paper that we pass, every policy statement, it's run by our membership for a vote. And that's very important.
Indeed, because that shows that the membership is actually behind it, not a few leaders who are making decisions and slapping on the label of that this is an organization-wide decision. So I think that's very, very good.
It's again, you know, what happened, what I was saying about private practice, where we turned over the care to medicine to lawyers and businessmen, which, you know, are definitely needed with the complexities of practice. But when doctors are not involved in that and are not making those decisions, that's when you lose some of those critical elements of medicine.
Excellent. So as executive director, what responsibilities do you feel most strongly about when it comes to shaping public understanding of children's health?
You know, it goes back to treating kids with just the utmost respect and dignity. And we believe that, you know, life is precious from, you know, moment of conception, fertilization, you know, up until natural death. And so my patients are, you know, in the womb. And so I will fight for life and it needs to be protected. You know, even children in the care that they receive to make sure that their bodies are protected and not damaged and experimented on. So just restoring dignity and respect for life and children is one of the best things you can do for medicine and for pediatrics.
Yes. And I mentioned this earlier, but you had a lot of courage to step out, not only this in this field, but also to represent the American College of Pediatricians as the executive director. And of course, this issue is so controversial in our culture. So what first led you as a pediatrician to publicly speak about the risks of hormonal and surgical interventions for children and teens with gender identity disorder?
It was not something I went into medicine for. And I wished this problem would just go away. Even when I joined the American College of Pediatricians, I thought, well, okay, there, you know, I joined this organization. There are people within the organization that can speak to this, and I can let others speak and learn from them. But I didn't feel like I was an expert or had any authority, and some fear for speaking out. I quickly realized the more you learn about this and just how awful it is, you can't look away. You can't not say anything. And I don't want to look back and say, you know, why didn't I do anything? And so it's really can be scary just in the fact that me speaking out can endanger others or my family. But it's not scary in the sense that it's very clear what the right thing to do is. And so sometimes the hardest thing is deciding what the right thing to do. Here it's very clear. And so then it's just a matter of going about it effectively and the best way that I can.
Well, thank you so much for that courage, because as we know in the medical community, a lot of people fear losing their jobs or getting reprimanded, et cetera, for speaking out against this. And as you said, it is abuse of a vulnerable child because it's mutilating their bodies, it's affecting their ability to have children later on, et cetera. So it does take courage, but we appreciate your courage in that. Now I want to switch over to a little bit to talk about the language. And obviously the language around this issue is very loaded. For example, we hear the term gender affirming care, quote unquote. Why should we not call it that? And why does accurate terminology matter so much in this discussion?
The language around this is meant to convey to parents and others that this is the right thing to do. This is medical treatment. And by using words like care or affirming, those are all positive. And maybe where this started, or some people at some level really do want to care for children and do want the best and think that they are caring. But when you look at the actual treatments themselves, they're not caring for this child. It's lying to a child. It's doing them harm. It's not affirming. It's actually taking a child's natural body and telling them that there's something wrong with it. And that is one of the cruelest things I think you can do to a child. Say that there is something so fundamentally wrong with you. You were born in the wrong body. It's neither of those. It's not affirming. It's not care. Children are either a boy or a girl. And you can have many different ways of being a boy or a girl. And that doesn't affect your biology. And so using terms like gender sort of confuses the issue of sex or biological sex. It adds in a lot of feelings and other things. We don't even really know what the definition of that is when it's used to try to explain something medical or scientific. So that term is just very confusing. And it may have started out with good intentions, but all it is right now is confusing the issue and misleading parents, children, and even doctors.
Right. And I liken it actually to the abortion issue, where you'll have terminology like, quote unquote, abortion care. Well, that's not care. You're killing a human being and you're hurting the mom, whether or not she realizes it. She might actually get physically injured in the process of an abortion, or emotionally, psychologically, all the above. So I do think that language is super important and in all of these contexts, because we have to talk about the reality. Parents are obviously, American College of Pediatricians helps parents. A lot of parents come to the website and contact you, especially parents who have children with gender identity disorder. How can they navigate the conflicting advice they get when helping their children with gender identity disorder? And for example, what resources can they find at biologicalintegrity.org, which is a website that the American College of Pediatricians launched?
So parents are so smart. They ultimately know their children the best. And in my years of practice, I have learned to trust parents' instincts. You know, when a parent comes in and says, you know, there's just something not right about my child, even if everything looks fine to me, you should trust that parent. So parents should know they should trust their instincts. Unfortunately, a lot of parents' instincts have been, corrupted or altered by a lot of things in that they're surrounded with, schools, culture. But, you know, parents have that innate instinct to protect their children. So when you go see a pediatrician should, you know, be recommending things that you feel comfortable with. If it's something that just doesn't seem to make sense, you know, I mean, it should be common sense that boy, you know, a child is a boy or a girl and that you can't change that. So obvious things from, you know, pediatricians telling you those sort of things, listen to your intuition and then just educate yourself. We've got, like you mentioned, the biologicalintegrity.org. It's a website designed mostly for parents, but also pediatricians and teens and policymakers, with easy to read fact sheets and information on all these topics around the gender ideology, transgender issues.
And I think it's so important for parents to choose the right pediatricians. If your pediatrician is saying, please step out of the room, I want to talk to your teen alone, or something like that, where you're wondering, why do I as a parent have to step out? I'm the first, not only educator, but protector of my child. So I do think it's important to find pediatricians that align with your values. ACPEDS.org also has, you can contact them to find pediatricians in your area, but also there are other organizations like the Catholic Medical Association, Christian Medical and Dental Association, and others that have directories, so that if you're worried about finding a pediatrician that aligns with your values, those are really good resources. I want to jump to the CAST review in the UK. It has sparked global discussion. And first of all, what is it for our listeners who are not familiar with the CAST review? And what lessons do you think that this report should give to American medical institutions? And what should they take away from the result of it?
The CAST review is a pediatrician by the name of Dr. Hilary CAST was tasked by the healthcare system in the UK to take a look at how children were being cared for. And she did an extensive review, talking with not only the gender clinics, the physicians, the families, the kids. She also commissioned some research to be done to look into some of these things. She even investigated outcomes and looked into the adult population for how their outcomes were. So this was an extremely thorough review of the care that was being done, the research, and she was tasked to do this and make recommendations. And her recommendations and the review, she issued a preliminary review even before the final one was done because she was so concerned about what was happening. And her recommendations ultimately led to the closing of the largest gender clinic, the Tavistock Gender Clinic, and to pause all this. And the, in addition to showing evidence of harm, there was just also such a paucity of research and poor quality research. And so the fact that this was being done without any good research, without any good evidence that it helped, and even some evidence that it was harming, was enough to shut it down. And it would be enough to shut anything down in medicine. And the fact that it's questioned and the fact that it's not regarded more highly here in the US or discussed is, it's kind of mind-boggling why more attention isn't given to it or more credibility isn't given to that in the US.
Well, American College of Pediatricians definitely did give it the attention it needed. ACPEDS was the leading author of the Doctors Protecting Children Declaration. And what is that declaration? And what do you hope it will achieve within the medical community? And again, what responsibility do healthcare professionals have toward the public?
For the past, really the past 5 years or so, as this issue has heated up and report after report or calls for investigations, people speaking out one after another, everyone within the American College of Pediatricians and other groups that are working with us kept thinking, okay, this is going to change the tide. Surely people can't ignore this or can't ignore this person. And when the CAST review came out, you know, that a lot of people thought, okay, this is really clear. We need to take another look at things in the U.S. And when it didn't have the profound effect we were all hoping for, we all sort of just said, enough. We got it. This has to stop. And we all were saying that amongst ourselves and amongst our circles. And at the American College of Pediatricians, we just thought, you know, we got to take the lead on this. We're the pediatricians. We can stand toe to toe, head to head with these other pediatricians and say that what you're doing is not right and it has to stop. And this is not consensus. We don't agree with you. We should look into this. We should discuss it, but it should stop. So we put together this declaration that called for the major medical organizations in the United States, like the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Medical Association, American Association of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and others to stop this, to stop promoting policies that promoted this. And we had it signed by leaders in many organizations, many that we maybe not don't work with on other issues, but came together on this. And so it was just a huge group of doctors and mostly pediatricians that signed this. The declaration also went around the country, went around the world, viral. I think Elon Musk picked it up and, you know, over 65 million views on his alone, you know, all around the world, lots of countries and doctors, people agreeing with us and signing. And so we stand by this. We still have people, you know, signing this and promoting it. It's a really good document. Anyone can go and sign and read about it, read about why, you know, we put the best reasons forward why this should stop. And you can sign as a medical professional, as a doctor, as a pediatrician, but also as a concerned citizen who are supporting these doctors, promoting a stop to this.
Yes. And as you mentioned, it went around the world. There are over 60 countries. People from over 60 countries signed this declaration. And Jill actually has the sign right behind her here in Doctors Protecting Children. So we encourage all of you to sign it, whether you're a healthcare professional or a stay-at-home mom or dad or whatever you might be, you can sign it. And this is following the latest research on the harms of the gender ideology. And so I think that this is actually a really good segue into those. Now, while we will be doing a whole separate episode on both the medical risks of cross-sex hormones and surgical interventions on children with gender identity disorder, I would love to hear from you a brief overview of the long-term medical effects that concern you most.
There are a lot of harms that can be done. I think one of the things to keep in mind through all of this is that in addition to doing harms, you're missing the basic reason why children are having this discomfort, this dysphoria. Why are they distressed? And so as soon as you go down that path of you're born in the wrong body, we're going to change your identity, we're going to do all this, alter your body, you stop looking at the root cause of this. And we know from studies that most of these children have underlying mental health problems like depression, anxiety. Many of them have had traumas, whether it's abuse, sexual abuse, or just difficult life events that have, like I talked about earlier in this segment, that have harmed them. Or a lot of these kids also have neurodevelopmental delays, things like autism. And that's important to know because those children think very concretely. And so if you tell them the reason you're not getting along socially is because you're born in the wrong body, they believe that wholeheartedly. They jump right in 2 feet and they believe that they can change. They don't understand the nuances that are involved. So my biggest concern with once you start treating children with gender dysphoria or discomfort in their sex, that pathway, you ignore all the other problems that the child may be having. So that was, I wanted to put emphasis on that because that's really where the solution lies in addressing that. But then if you look at what this pathway does, once you start so-called affirming a child or telling them that they are the opposite sex and then that they can believe the opposite sex, you put them on this conveyor belt or a train that is really difficult to get off. So it starts right there. It seems harmless, letting them dress in clothes, you know, more appropriate for the opposite sex or, you know, choosing a different name. But it really sets them up on this conveyor belt and it's very hard to get off. So that is dangerous to even start. And then puberty blockers are touted as You just pause puberty, give a child to think. They're totally reversible. And that is completely a lie. Dr. Cass explained this very well in her review, that puberty is a time where children who have this gender dysphoria, most of them will outgrow it. If they're allowed and supported through natural puberty, is, you know, the hormones are needed to bathe the brain during this process and develop their thoughts. And all of us experience discomfort during puberty. And so right. to work through that, and, you know, that is necessary for a child's growth, those hormones, and it actually helps them be comfortable when they get on the other side of puberty. So when you stop that, you take away one of the best treatments we have for this. And, you know, why would you intervene with anything in medicine that has a rate of anywhere from, 80% to high 90s of naturally going away on its own. So we shouldn't intervene. But so those puberty blockers, pause puberty, we know that puberty is also necessary for a lot of important brain development, IQ, intelligence, all of that. We know so little even about what all those hormones do during development. So if you were to restart it, you can't catch up. You can't make up for that, for what that child has lost. And then you now have a child who is out of sync with all of their peers in development. And so that's the dangers of puberty blockers. And then if you keep a child on puberty blockers and then you pause them at an early stage of puberty before they've had time for any of their sexual organs to develop, egg, sperm, all that, and then you put them on opposite sex hormones, this will sterilize a child because they will never develop the ability, they will never fully develop those gametes, the sperm and egg that are necessary for reproduction. So they'll never have children of their own. So that right there is a big consequence of these treatments. And then these opposite sex hormones are delivered in really high quantities, and they are not intended to be in the body at those high levels. And the child would need to stay on those for the rest of their life. So you've medicalized a person for life. Their body will never take over production of those hormones on their own. So you've medicalized them. And then if you say, well, you know, if you're still not happy, let's do surgeries. Well, then you're talking about changing, removing, altering completely healthy body parts. And that is just not something we do in medicine. We would not do that for any other thing. And so, you know, you obviously you can sterilize, but these children who have had these procedures done, they leave big scars, lots of consequences, damaging to their body, you know, a lifetime of pain and medicalization.
Yeah, I want to go dig in a little deeper into that. You mentioned that their sperm or eggs don't fully actualize. And by that, do you mean that they don't fully mature because of the cross-sex hormones? How does that affect, and you mentioned obviously with arresting puberty that it sets them back even among their peers. But if you can talk a little bit about that too.
Right. So during puberty, there's different stages. During those stages is when our bodies, those organs that produce sperm and the eggs or ova, they mature and they need to go through that process. It's hormonal. There's a lot involved in there. And if you stop it before that, females will not have mature ova or eggs that can ever be fertilized. Boys will never be able to produce mature sperm. It just doesn't happen. And so there's a push to put children on puberty blockers at early and earlier stages in development to try to prevent some of the become secondary sex characteristics like facial hair and deepening voice. But when you stop them that early, then you stop them before the internal development is going on, and you lose that ability to have children.
The things you mentioned, like the cross-sex hormones and the surgical interventions, there are other practices that are being done, they're being encouraged, and they're also harmful. So some young people engage in practices like chest binding or genital tucking. First of all, what are those practices? And what are the potential medical risks of these practices that parents and the general public should know about?
I appreciate this question because as uncomfortable as it is to talk about and listen to, when people hear things like this and really understand what these kids are doing, you realize that it's not harmless. And I think they think that dressing like the opposite sex and these things that they do are just harmless. It's when you get into the chemicals and the, you know, hormones, that's when it's dangerous. But even these things involved in dressing and making yourself look like the opposite sex are harmful. So chest binding is something that girls will do to flatten their chest to appear more masculine. And just like it sounds, they, you know, either use, they make these, you can buy them online, chest binders, or, you know, wrap tight wraps around their chest. Obviously, this sounds uncomfortable, but it also can affect how a girl is breathing, how their spine, their posture, their breast tissue development. They can be left with lifelong harms from doing that, because these girls will do it all day and just be very uncomfortable. And how can you learn, sit in class when you are so uncomfortable like that? In addition to rashes and all sorts of irritation that can go on. So that's what the girls will do to try to look more masculine. The boys will do something called tucking, where they will actually tuck their testicles into their inguinal canals. And it sounds as awful as it is, it can be painful. It is also dangerous. Testicles are designed to be outside the body because they need to be at a lower temperature to develop sperm. You can cause them damage being internal. Also, things like urinary tract infections, they keep them bound. They sometimes tape them. So in addition, like the girls having rashes and infections and irritation just from the physical restraints that they use to do that. So, and also not very comfortable for these young boys sitting there trying to do school or sports, you know, with these sorts of contraptions on.
It sounds so awful. And I think that it's very jarring to hear these things, but I think it's important for people to hear these things, because when we're talking about this issue, a lot of people may want to glaze over the things that are basically the underbelly, the dark side of it. And we will be exposing the dark side of it, because I think that that's what it will take for people to understand how harmful these things are and how unnatural, right? Because you're taking healthy body parts and maiming them, or, you know, pausing their normal development. And so here you're actually causing a disorder to your own body, or to someone's body if you're a pediatrician or a doctor who's complicit in this and doing this to children. I wanted to talk a little bit about how terrible this is, that with children, their minds and their brains are not mature enough to make these types of permanent life-altering decisions. You know, their brain matures much later. We don't let children drink alcohol before 21 or buy cigarettes before 18, all these things, because we know that their brains take longer to develop. And so until they become adults, there's decisions that will affect their health, their life. But it just seems so wrong that on something like this, that can certainly have life-altering consequences on their life, that these things are happening all around the world. Can you talk a little bit about the brain development, and also how have we gotten to this point where this is even allowed?
Yeah, and you know, even just looking at all the things we've been talking about and how obvious it seems and why this is still allowed to go on, this is yet another one of those things that should put a stop to this medical protocol or recommendation. You know, the fact that this is all based on what the child thinks or what the child wants. You know, they say they're a boy, so they must be a boy, you know, even though they're biologically a girl. So the fact that you are putting so much in that right there should be a full stop. And we know in medicine that, and as a pediatrician, developmentally, kids do not think, they do not have that ability to predict the future, to think abstractly. There's so many studies now, and we've got a great paper on our website about the teen brain. But there's so many studies that show that the frontal cortex and the decision-making parts of the brain are really not fully developed until the mid-20s. And most parents or anyone who's been a kid knows this is so true. Their decisions are influenced by a lot of emotion, their friends, they're not capable of making such life-altering decisions. And that's why it's important for parents. And that's why as a pediatrician, the parents are just as important in their care because they need to, you know, help make these decisions and they know what's best for their child. So children cannot consent to these treatments. And I would argue also parents can't consent to this when they aren't given the appropriate information. So, you know, children just developmentally can't consent, can't comprehend what's at stake. And we should not be letting children do these things. We as doctors should be recommending things that will help them and ultimately protect them and know that they're not capable of doing this. So it's very disappointing.
So would you say that this is child abuse? Is this malpractice? How would you characterize this, especially since you have grown adults with medical degrees who are pushing this on families and children, and especially the children who, like you said, don't actually have a mature brain until they're 25 years old, well past the time that they become adult.
Right. Yeah. In my mind, you know, it does fall under malpractice. It's certainly not ethical medical care, which we all as doctors swore to protect our patients, to do no harm. And so it goes against our ethics as doctors. Mm-hmm.
You spoke about how the underlying trauma, abuse, or mental health challenges affect a child's potentially their gender identity disorder. So how do counseling, family therapy, and other non-medical supports fit into a long-term care plan for children with gender identity disorder?
That really is the mainstay of treatment, is to have these children be evaluated. By evaluated, I mean also neurodevelopmentally. These kids with autism or autism spectrum disorders and other neurodevelopment disorders need to be identified, but then also by a truly caring, trained mental health professional who can involve the family and the child and help them through this.
And that's really necessary. And again, if you go to biologicalintegrity.org, there are links to counseling groups and directories to find the kinds of counselors that can actually help your child work through the trauma or the underlying issue. Critics often argue that by withholding hormones or surgeries, that increases the risk of depression or suicide in a child. How do you respond to that claim?
It's false. If you hear nothing else, the claim that children will commit suicide if they are not allowed to become the opposite sex through all these methods, that is a complete lie. And this is what is being told to parents, that, you know, if they don't go along with these so-called medical treatments and therapies, that their child's going to kill themselves. And we have studies that show it's just absolutely not true. And so, yeah, I can't emphasize that enough, to not be emotionally persuaded by that argument.
Is there an actual increase in suicide or suicidal ideation in children who have gone through these procedures, as opposed to the opposite, which is being claimed?
You know, we're starting to learn a lot more about children who have gone through, you know, whatever stages of, whether it's just social affirmation or puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and detransitioning is what they're called, where they go back to accepting their biological sex and working through that. And unfortunately, these kids or young adults is what they are a bit neglected because they don't want to seek care from the doctors who treated them, obviously. And they're just very fearful of the whole medical, just any medical institution, medical doctors. And so we don't have very good studies on these children after, but we do know that a lot of them are just devastated by the harm that's happened to them or that they were convinced to do. And so I don't even need to see big numbers of studies. You listen to one or two or just one of these children who's been harmed and you will say, this can't happen to any other child. And that's why they speak out. It's very hard for kids who have been harmed to speak out But the brave ones who do, you know, that's why they do it. They don't want to have any other child go through what they did. And I just applaud them. And we should all back them up that no child should go through this.
Absolutely. They are so courageous. And from my understanding, generally, like you mentioned, children who have had some underlying trauma, abuse, et cetera, are more susceptible to gender identity disorder. And so when they first go in that direction, they are, quote unquote, love bombed by the advocates of that kind of lifestyle. And so for a child who is now questioning his or her decision to go in that direction, it's very hard to pull back because you've lose that community that was there for you. That community turns against detransitioners, doesn't support their detransition. And sadly, these detransitioners, as you mentioned, they have to sometimes go back to the same doctors that quote unquote transition them to try to get help in detransitioning. And that puts them in a very awkward situation where they have to go back to the same doctors because there are not a lot of doctors who want to be involved in this because it is a very controversial practice. But the detransitioner community is so strong, and I believe that their testimony is so powerful because they're the ones who lived through it and they're the best ones to tell the story of how they've been harmed. So I think that their witness is going to help put an end to this. How do you think that state and federal legislation, what role should it play in regulating these procedures for minors?
My hope has been all along that as doctors, we take care of this problem, that we do like we have throughout history, have discussion, present the evidence, and as doctors decide this is not something that we should be doing. Unfortunately, it's not happening fast enough. I do have faith in my profession and my colleagues that we will eventually, but children need help now. This needs to stop now. And so there needs to be protections in the government level, whether it's, you know, hopefully federal, but state also to support that, that will protect children much the same way that we have malpractice, you know, laws and other things that protect patients, from harmful practices.
And on that topic, there are a number of gender clinics that have closed. What do you attest to that result, and how can local communities and the local governments, again, ensure that the children in their communities are not exposed to these practices?
It speaks to once people start to learn about this. So, you know, thank you for bringing this to your audience and, you know, asking these in-depth questions. Because the more people hear about this and find out what's going on, the direction then is to stop this. No one looks at what's happening and says, let's have more of this. You know, so once you find out really what's going on, when people can wrap their heads around what's going on, then it stops. And so once, you know, you have a couple and then you start hearing more about it, then you have more closing down. So this is only going to continue. Some clinics, some states are going to fight harder because they're more dug in. But people protecting children, like the American College of Pediatricians, are just as determined to bring this to light. And so thanks again for bringing this to your podcast.
Absolutely. And I want to bring everyone's attention back to biologicalintegrity.org, because there you will find not only FAQs on the medical effects of all of these procedures, et cetera, but resources for parents, for teens, for policymakers. There's also an interactive map with information about where legislation exists to protect children. And there's also another interactive map with hospital closures of these gender clinics. And so you can keep track of where the trend is going and to see if the clinics in your area have closed. And if not, I do believe it's the public's responsibility to also raise awareness and put pressure on their local hospitals if they are doing these types of procedures on children.
Absolutely. And just real quick for the policymakers who are listening, this is a winning issue. The majority of Americans do not think that children should be subject to these harmful procedures and chemicals. So it really, the more people hear about it, this will stop.
Absolutely. So on a personal note, what gives you hope in the debate about what is the best course of treatment for children with gender identity disorder?
The best hope is that we are talking about it. We are pediatricians. I see more and more are feeling comfortable standing up against their places of work and their organizations and at least calling for discussion. And where that is happening, that is fantastic. And I think we should focus on listening more and hearing these facts. So that gives me great hope, is that I'm seeing more and more pediatricians. I used to get a lot of calls. I mean, I still do, but pediatricians saying, great work. I support what you're doing, but I have to kind of stay in the sidelines because I might lose my job. And now we're getting more members. We're getting, more people wanting to get involved and speaking out. So there's definitely a shift. I can feel it. And I think we can all see it when we turn on the TV or the news, see what's happening around us.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is your message to pediatricians who might still be afraid of speaking out? And not just pediatricians, but healthcare professionals or parents who are afraid to speak out about it in their schools. They're seeing that this is something that's going on in their schools. What do you tell people who are still afraid to come out of the shadows and actually have the courage to say something about this?
Well, to my pediatric colleagues, I will say we have a responsibility to say something. We have a responsibility not only to our patients, but to our profession, to when we see something, to call attention to it. You know, we have protocols in the operating room and before we do procedures that if anyone is not comfortable or sees something wrong, that they should speak out. And this, above anything right now in pediatrics, is something that pediatricians should be, at least if you don't know much about it, which it's hard to nowadays, educate yourself, read about this. You don't have to take my word for it. Read the CAS report, read anything you can and educate yourself. Join groups, join us, the American College of Pediatricians, and talk to other like-minded pediatricians that give support and start small. I know it takes a lot of courage and it's scary. And I would never ask anyone to, publicly do anything that puts themselves or others at harm. But there's a lot you can do behind the scenes. You know, you mentioned encouraging your legislators or community members, writing things, or just even talking to your own children about this. Your own family does a lot. And that's most important, is your children and your family.
Yes. And it really takes all of us. So it's whatever circle, community, the closest people to you, friends and family, even just sharing with them when there is the right time or the topic of conversation comes up, and just sharing this is already sharing knowledge that they may not already have. And so if they're open to discussing this issue right there in your own very small circle of friends and family, you can make a big difference. And again, approaching it with compassion, empathy, and only if they really want to engage on the topic, it's important to for us, wherever we are, to share that when there's an openness to discussing it. And finally, what is your vision for how pediatric care should approach gender identity disorder over the next 5 to 10 years?
So, first of all, this can't stop fast enough. So as quickly as we can stop this, but we do need to have then a place for kids to go. And so for the kids who are affected by this, encouraging and supporting our mental health professionals in doing the work that they do to really honestly look at the whole child, why they're feeling like this. So supporting those counselors who are doing good work, supporting families, because as you just said, families are the most important, and children need their mom and their dad. They need to be supported. And so anything we can do as communities to support strong families who can love their children like no one else, that is what we need to do. And then, for the children who've not been exposed to this, the really young children, we need to make sure that as they're growing, they're not immersed in a culture that normalizes the thought that you could be either a boy or a girl, or you could be born a boy, but really a girl. We need to stop that. We need to stop exposing children to that. So it's going to take a long time to untangle ourselves from this. I hope the harms can stop immediately, but the healing of the children and the future generation it's going to take a lot of work. And it goes back to the fundamentals, protecting the family, supporting them, you know, again, bringing that excellence back to pediatric care. What's the best thing to do for these kids?
Thank you so much, Dr. Simons, for joining us. Your voice and your courage are really needed, especially on this topic. And we really appreciate you stepping out and the fact that the American College of Pediatricians is really on the front lines and guiding people with medical evidence, with science. It's all evidence-based. And so that's what we need in this conversation, this cultural conversation. And the fact that there are pediatricians who really understand what's at stake is refreshing. Do you have resources that you recommend to people?
Well, our website, and thank you for bringing that up all throughout the show, biologicalintegrity.org is just your go-to place. It's a trusted source put together by pediatricians. The Doctors Protecting Children Declaration, go check that out. Very concise. You can get behind supporting that. And then American College of Pediatricians, .org, our website. Join if you're a pediatrician out there looking for, support from like-minded colleagues. We're here for you. The door's open. So thank you for bringing to light those. And thank you for bringing this up again. And congratulations, Arena, on the podcast. It's incredible.
Thank you so much. And we are going to link to all of these resources in at the end of the show. And so you'll have access to all of this information. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you again, Dr. Simons. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Bioethics Babe podcast. If you've enjoyed this content, please subscribe to my YouTube channel and your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends and family. Also check out bioethicsbabe.com for the latest episodes and resources.